listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Today, the Democratic National Convention kicked off in Philadelphia. The convention promises a United Together theme tonight, even as the party responds to leaked emails from the Democratic National Committee. Those emails suggested the party work to undermine Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign for president and led party chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz to announce her resignation yesterday.
WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is in Philadelphia this week at the convention. He's with us now to talk about the latest news. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So set the scene for us at day one of the convention in Philadelphia.
Day one of the convention in Philadelphia has got a different feel than the convention in Cleveland in a lot of different ways. I think when you went to Cleveland downtown, you were struck by an almost fortress-like feel to it. Especially around the convention center and around the arena where people were speaking. They had pretty tall steel fences surrounding all the structures, a lot of security checkpoints. Just getting from the convention center to the arena, you could hop on a shuttle and it'd be, I guess, easy to shoot through these police checkpoints all over the place. So far, really none of that here. I mean, the city has a more open feel to it downtown, maybe not so much around the arena where people are speaking tonight, but even without the security, there have actually been more protests here. And it's sounding like tonight, at least in the early going, we're going to have a pretty potentially chaotic vote on the rules on the floor of the convention tonight.
And that's similar to the chaotic vote on the rules at the floor of the Republican convention. It sounds like the idea of whether or not there's a roll call vote, something like that. What would be at stake in this vote?
Yeah, so this is this is essentially Sanders supporters who are unhappy for a variety of reasons right now who want to push this platform to the left. And essentially the platform and the rules are what govern things like whether or not the Democratic Party has superdelegates. That stuff has already been approved by committees made up of a mix of Sanders supporters and Clinton supporters, and now it's to the full floor. And so the full floor is where all these people who, some of them going to a convention for the first time, some of them maybe going to their only convention, some of them new to the political process, they have a chance to say their piece, even if it's yelling. And so I think you may see that in the early going here in the convention and just some of the speeches that are really just formalities. When the speakers would mention Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine, you would hear boos in the arena. I'm not in the arena physically. I'm right across the sidewalk from it as we speak right here. So I can't tell you exactly where those are coming from, but I think it's easy to surmise that they're coming from Sanders supporters who are unhappy with the way things have been going and, not tied to the same customs, maybe, that Democrats that have been around for longer.
Democrats are hoping for a message of party unity. They're probably disappointed by this WikiLeaks release of internal emails from the Democratic Party throughout the convention that ultimately forced party chairwoman convention chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz to announce her resignation from that slot. There was talk that she'd kind of ceremonial kick things off, bang the gavel, and then disappear. Now, not even that, it sounds like, right?
Yeah, she was, it sounded like, really wanted to open the convention. I mean, she put a lot of work into it. Talking to people who are close to her, they said she basically put her life on hold to help organize this convention. And so she wanted to be there. And it sounded like until just a few hours ago, she was going to be. And you can only imagine what sound there would have been in the arena from Sanders supporters had she been. She decided not to in the name of party unity, but you're still hearing some boos over there.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. He is in Philadelphia for the Democratic Convention. Sean, as the Republican Wisconsin delegation did, it sounds like the Democratic delegation is getting together in the morning. You went to their breakfast. What kind of things were you hearing?
Yeah, one of the people who spoke was Congresswoman Gwen Moore. Congresswoman Gwen Moore is... usually you get her in a room full of Democrats, and she's a pretty popular person, I guess, in that setting. They like her jokes. They like kind of the way that she weaves her speeches. together. There's really not somebody else within the Wisconsin congressional delegation or the state house, for that matter, who can speak like her. And one of the things she talked about was the protests that we are seeing in Philadelphia now, and the fact that we've seen probably more protests in this convention, a lot of them by Bernie Sanders supporters against Hillary Clinton, than we saw in Cleveland. And Glenn Moore said that growing up, she was in protests all the time. She was in these anti-war protests against racial inequality. She's not unused to protesting. But she said that when it comes to this election, that Democrats need to be careful how they protest. Here's what Glenn Moore had to say.
Let me tell you, you cannot protest by voting for some third party or do what I used to do sometimes, write my son's name in when I didn't like any of the candidates. That kind of protest is not going to work.
We mentioned the theme for tonight at the convention is United Together. That's something she was trying to get at there. What are you hearing from other Democratic delegates at the convention?
Well, a lot of the talk this morning about whether or not they were united was kind of framed in terms of that. What does the Debbie Wasserman Schultz news do for the party? And, you know, does that make it harder to unify? A question was posed to Democratic Party of Wisconsin Chair Martha Lanning, and she essentially said that she thinks that Sanders supporters will eventually come around to Hillary Clinton because of the prospect that if they don't, they could have a President Donald Trump. Here's Democratic Party Chair Martha Lanning.
I think the Sanders supporters know that Donald Trump is a huge threat to our nation. You know, the thing is we have a gentleman here who is a con. He's sexist. He's a bigot. And we cannot allow someone like him to be leading our nation. The Sanders supporters are seeing Bernie supporting Hillary by coming out and endorsing her. And I believe that that's going to bring people together just like it did in 2008.
So, Sean, last week it felt like the most unifying figure at the Republican convention was Hillary Clinton. That was the one thing everybody there seemed to agree about. Will it be the inverse here? Everybody's going to agree that they don't like Donald Trump?
Yeah, it seems like just kind of a mirror image, or I guess, what is the image, Rob? It's flipped around, exactly. And so everybody, at least party leaders, are saying, this is the reason you need to unify because of Donald Trump. Just as last week, they were saying, this is the reason you need to unify. You don't want to have President Hillary Clinton. You did hear, though, some concern among the vice chair of Wisconsin's Democratic Party, David Bowen. He's a state representative from Milwaukee. He's also, notably, Bernie Sanders' only announced superdelegate in Wisconsin. He made that announcement shortly after the primary, after Sanders won Wisconsin's primary. And David Bowen told reporters that the emails that came out over the weekend did not help toward unifying the party.
Sanders supporters were told that, you know, that wasn't happening. Finally, the writing is on the wall, but it's coming at a cost, right? Because it's distracting us from the number one goal of the convention, that's to unify. So I think her stepping down was the right thing in the situation. We don't need that a distraction if we truly want to build unity with both Sanders and Clinton supporters.
Sean, as we look ahead to the primetime speakers, we had just a litany of Wisconsin politicos at the Republican convention, not quite as much from the Democrats, it looks like.
No, not as much. We're going to have one more speak to the full convention. It sounds like Tammy Baldwin will speak to the full convention. She'll be on stage, possibly with a group of senators in front of the full convention, not like the Republican convention, though, where you had seven Republicans get up there and deliver remarks to the full convention. But you do have a lineup tonight of, you know, if you're a party that's seeking unity and seeking to bring along Sanders supporters, this tonight's lineup seems geared toward that. You have Bernie Sanders speaking himself, and you have First Lady Michelle Obama speaking. You also have Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking, who's a favorite of the left. So I imagine you'll hear all of them preaching unity tonight, but they may be coming after kind of a cacophony of boos following these rules votes, depending on how things shake out.
Sean, we'll check on all that with you tomorrow. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. He's joining us every afternoon this week from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an addiction expert about new federal action aimed at curbing heroin and prescription drug abuse.
But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
She was a vaudeville performer, fashion icon, radio star, and an exotic musical performer. Norman Gilliland brings us the story of the small-town Wisconsin girl who became an international celebrity.
What do Madonna, Beyoncé, and Miss Piggy have in common? They and many others followed in the footsteps of a charismatic, talented, and vaguely exotic singer who also went by just one name.
Ladies and gentlemen, the incomparable Hildegard.
Hildegard Loretta Sell was born in Adel, Wisconsin in 1906 into a German-American family. When the Sells moved to Milwaukee, Hildegard enrolled in the School of Music at Marquette University, intending to become a concert pianist.
Practicing the piano.
But after seeing a vaudeville act, four women playing four baby grand pianos at the same time, she decided to become an entertainer.
Tick-tock. Tick-tock.
She joined a troupe of touring performers playing the piano in the pit orchestra. Her life took another turn when she met Anna Sosenko in a New Jersey boarding house. Sosenko was a burgeoning songwriter, and for Hildegard, she wrote a bilingual ditty that would make the singer famous from coast to coast.
This song is about an English boy who falls in love with a French girl. Ooh la la.
In 1935, for Pathé Pictorial, Hildegard went on camera and recorded Darling, Je Vous Aime Beaucoup.
Darling, je vous aime beaucoup, je ne sais pas what to do.
At Sosenko's suggestion, Hildegard started wearing elegant gowns and shoulder-length gloves. When the two undertook a European tour, Sosenko reported to newspapers back in the States that important people on the continent had become enthralled by the American chanteuse.
Right from the start.
Suddenly, Hildegard was an international celebrity.
You love me too.
Her admirers included King Gustav of Sweden and the Duke of Windsor. Eleanor Roosevelt would later call her the First Lady of Supper Clubs. She had a top 10 radio show and traveled with her own orchestra.
Hildegard, you came here to sing, and darn if we're not going to hold you to it.
Of course, buddy. It's the beautiful ballad, I'll Close My Eyes.
By April 17, 1939, when Life magazine put her face on its cover, only one word was necessary, Hildegard.
I'll close my eyes.
A young pianist, also from Milwaukee, went to see her often when she was playing the Empire Room at the Palmer House in Chicago. He admired her flashy entrances, flamboyant playing, and lavish costumes. And when he launched his career, he too went by just one name, Liberace.
I'll lock my heart.
Endorsements and investments kept Hildegard financially secure well after her fame had peaked, and a sense of humor must have helped to keep her healthy. Miss Piggy got the gloves idea from me, she joked.
Do you ever hand out roses around the gentlemen sitting at ringside tables?
I don't hand them out, I throw them out.
During a lifetime that lasted just 6 months short of 100 years, Hildegard never married. But she left a rich showbiz legacy that many performers continue to draw from today.
Would you like to hear the story of a girl that many soldiers know?
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Joining us now to tell us more about Wisconsin's own incomparable Hildegard is Monica Gallimore. She's a history lecturer at the University of Central Oklahoma. She wrote her dissertation on Hildegard at Marquette University that's being published this year. Monica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me today. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, for such a huge celebrity, it seems like we've kind of forgotten Hildegard. What drew you to her?
Well, I was looking in January, February of 2006 to write my master's essay about women in music. I'm a musician, I'm a women's historian, and so I was looking for at Marquette University for, you know, local collections where I would have access to interesting, you know, somebody who was interesting and someone perhaps who had not been written about. And I did find that there was a collection at Marquette University that were the Hildegard papers. And I read the collection, you know, the information on it, and I thought, oh, that's interesting, and I kind of moved on. But something continued to nag at me about it, and I started to look her up. And the first thing that I found was her obituary. She had passed away in July the year before, in 2005. And her obituaries spanned the globe. I mean, she had obituaries in Australia and all over, numerous newspapers in London and New York, and they were heralding her as this great performer and this, you know, this woman who set style and fashion and made numerous songs famous. And I thought, well, that's, you know, somebody that I should probably look into. And the more I got into who she was, the more I realized that this would not just be a master's thesis, this would end up being my work for my dissertation, and that's exactly what it has been. And will also be published with McFarland Publishers as a book in late fall, early winter 2017. But that's how I originally kind of came upon her, as I realized that something was going on that, as you said, we don't really know who this woman is and why.
So you got to know her pretty well. There were diaries, you read her papers, you're publishing a dissertation on her. What do we know about what she was like and how she came to be this kind of extraordinary person for her time?
Well, she thankfully, kindly, left us roughly 70 years of diaries. So, and by us, I mean now we have them. We did not have them for a long time. And one of the things that happened to her that was the most influential thing was that she met the young woman who would be her manager for around 25 years, and that was a woman named Anna Sisenko. And Anna became transformative for Hildegard. Hildegard, in 1926, had started performing with vaudeville, and she finds herself traveling out of Wisconsin, out of Milwaukee. And she was very popular. She went from show to show, but when she met and then became friends with and eventually went into a partnership with Anna, it changed her. And it changes her because they move, it was together that they moved to Europe. And when they moved to Europe is when Hildegard kind of hones her performance and who she is, and a skill set that I think she would not have had otherwise, being able to play piano and sing in cabarets and things like that. But I believe, though, that one of the most important things for her was the fact that she had this opportunity growing up to have musical instruction and to be able to perform live in Milwaukee at silent movie theaters. She played music for silent movie theaters for several years while she was in high school and then when she was at Marquette University. And I believe that what that meant for her to have that access, you know, to performance early on meant that by the time she starts in vaudeville, she was already a very well-seasoned performer. I don't think she had the same shakiness or nervousness that any other performer would have starting in vaudeville at a very young age. So I think that really that ability to have performed locally for numerous years really created and laid the foundation for her to become even more adept at what she did.
Was she a local star, a local celebrity before she became this international icon?
I wouldn't say she was a celebrity. She was known, though. She was a piano player, and she was also would play organs for the silent movie theaters. But she also performed at Marquette University and eventually was a person who was playing for the Gimbel's department store in downtown Milwaukee and was playing on their radio program that they would broadcast out of Gimbel's, and kind of became known that way as well. So she wasn't well-known, but she had, I think, respect among musicians, especially in Milwaukee, and I think that helped her make a transition to hitting the stage with the vaudeville shows she went with.
And we heard that she apparently was a big influence on Liberace. Did the two of them know each other and have any kind of relationship?
Well, I'm not sure if you would call it a relationship. They did know each other. He starts out, I would say, no offense to Liberace fans out there, he was sort of obsessed with her when he was young. and he would go to any performance that he could go to of Hildegard's, he would go to it. And he actually said, he said numerous times, that the very first time that he ever saw a red carpet actually rolled out for somebody was for Hildegard. And when he saw it, he said he knew that that is what he wanted. And so he emulated her, including just taking the one name. She, later on, commented to a friend that he copped my whole act. That was
wow.
a direct quote from her, except for the candelabra. She didn't have the candelabra, so she joked that he did add that to his act. So
it would be easy to look at pop culture now and list a lot of people with one name or two who have really figured out their celebrity identity and carefully crafted that persona. Uh-huh. Was she one of the people, though, who made that a thing, who paved the ground for all the people who are in the top 40 today?
I think she did. And I think that it wasn't just her, though. It's very important that that we understand that Anna Sisenko created the personality that we knew of as the incomparable Hildegard. She honed that when they were specifically in Europe. And Anna Sisenko would talk about having created an image and then selling it to the American public. And that's exactly what she did. Were they very aware of her, the fact that they had created this persona? They were absolutely aware of it. Even in 1963, Hildegard published an autobiography where she also creates her image. It is this constant, it's this myth that she creates about who she is. And I think it's very common in celebrity culture, especially with autobiographies. But this, creating a concept of rags to riches and how poor she was growing up and how she wasn't, used to this or, having money or being able to afford to have new dresses. And none of that was really true. But that was continuing on in that vein of creating a persona that was sold to the American public. And she always had that. I think she always was on, always. She referred to it as the downstairs Hildegard. That's what she called her public persona.
Interesting stuff. Monica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you all having me.
That was Monica Gallimore, a history lecturer at the University of Central Oklahoma. We've been talking about Wisconsin's own incomparable Hildegard.
Coming up, we talk about a new bill signed by President Obama aimed at treating opioid addiction as a health problem. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, join NPR for coverage of day one of the Democratic National Convention. They'll be bringing live coverage and analysis all week in Philadelphia. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, a bill signed into law on Friday could change the way we look at addiction. Over the last year, Congress saw more than a dozen bills tackling opioid addiction. The Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act of 2016 was a blend of some of those bills, and after getting congressional approval, it was signed into law by President Obama.
The bill got support from Republicans and Democrats, and despite signing it, the president still expressed concern that the bill didn't go far enough. In a statement last week, Obama said some action is better than none, and that he was disappointed in Republicans for not allocating more funding for addiction recovery.
Becky Vaughn joins us now. She's the Vice President of Addictions at the National Council for Behavioral Health. Becky, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. I always appreciate shining a spotlight on this issue.
And before we get into the particulars of what this bill does, a lot of people have been paying attention to the tone it takes, the approach to opioid addiction. What changes in the way this bill tackles that issue?
Well, that is probably one of the biggest positive things about this bill. When we look back at the history of how addiction has been treated in the public policy world, it's mostly been a focus on many times the attitude that people are weak or immoral, and if they just stop, there wouldn't be a problem. We've looked at it from a criminal justice perspective, more stringent laws, more mandatory sentences. And really, this is the first bill that we, freestanding addiction bill, that we've had come through Congress in over 30 years. So just the fact that the tone has changed to the recognition that this is a health issue, that it needs to be treated like a health issue, and that it can't be ignored anymore because being ignored has created this emergency situation.
Does treating it as a health issue, treating addiction as a health issue, work better? Does it ultimately give better results than treating it as a criminal justice issue or a moral issue?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen over the years that you absolutely can't arrest your way out of this problem. We've tried that approach. It hasn't worked. You often put people who are addicted in prison. They come out addicted. They still don't get the services they need. But when you start looking at the research that NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and NIAAA, their alcoholic sister in terms of research, we recognize the brain changes. Out of that, we've had treatment modalities come about that are now best practices. They have evidence behind them. And we see people getting into recovery, living their lives, managing this chronic disease, and really being productive citizens, which is the way they always wanted to be, too. They're reconnecting with families. They have stable jobs. So we know that when you get people the treatment they need, that they can have a life in recovery.
You mentioned that we're in an emergency situation when it comes to opioid addiction. We've talked about this issue a lot here in Wisconsin. It's a well-recognized problem here. Can you set the national stage? How bad is this?
Well, it is bad. What has brought it to most people's attention at this point is a very sharp increase in the use of prescription drugs in a harmful way. There's a lot of good things about these prescription drugs when they're used appropriately, but when they're abused, they end up in a harmful way, and as a result, we've seen a sharp increase in the number of overdose deaths as a result. Now, for those of us who have been working in the field for a long time, we often see this as the drug du jour. We look back on the crack epidemic. We look back on methamphetamine. The real issue is addiction, and the fact that even today we're only treating about 20% of the people who need these services. Now, if we were doing that in a field like diabetes or hypertension, people would be outraged. But this has been ignored, and our prevention funding has been cut and slashed over the years. So many of our children and adolescents and young adults don't get the message about how dangerous these drugs are and understand what low-risk choices are when it comes to their use. And so as a result, we've got people, particularly adolescents, kids, and young adults, who think that these drugs have been approved by the FDA, so they must be safe, and they end up getting in trouble with them.
We're talking to Becky Vaughn from the National Council for Behavioral Health about new anti-opioid addiction legislation passed big bipartisan margin in Congress, signed into law last week by President Obama. On a practical level, what does this new legislation do, Becky?
Well, the good news is it really approaches it from a comprehensive kind of overview. We've had lots of bills that have been proposed over the years that almost look more like Band-Aids, trying to attack this piece or that piece. And because we took what the Senate started with and then all of the pieces that the House also was trying to address and pulled them together, we now have a bill that talks about what a framework and what the infrastructure should be for treatment, for prevention, for making sure there's support for recovery in the community, just like other people with chronic diseases get support. There is good infrastructure and authorized funding for reversing these deadly overdoses, making drugs like Narcan more available so that we save people's lives when they overdose. It also increases that access to treatment and makes it so that we can make better use of medications that are now available to help with treatment, something, you know, we haven't had in the past. It also looks at law enforcement and best practices in law enforcement so that they're not dealing with the same people over and over again, but instead getting them where they need to be to get help, and criminal justice reform in terms of how our courts are handling this and where people are going into drug courts and other diversion things, once again, to get them the help that they need instead of filling our prisons with them.
In signing this, President Obama released a statement saying, doing a little is better than doing nothing. He said he was very disappointed in the amount of funding, much less than he had asked for from Congress. Is this, even though there's a more comprehensive approach, given those funding levels, is this a Band-Aid?
You could call it that. Obviously, we are still very much advocating for this bill to basically B, the authorization for funding, and now we need the appropriators to do their job and put the actual funds to make this happen. Yes, we absolutely applaud the president. He has proposed a $1.1 billion budget over the next 2 years in mandatory funding. We just want Congress to understand that while this infrastructure and the fact that they've put in great policies around nurse practitioners and physician assistants being able to help with this, we have to have additional funding to make any of this work. So we don't see this as the end. In many ways, we know this is a marathon. We've just kind of finished the 5K, and now we're ready to go on to the next leg of making sure that we now get funding in order to put these things into place.
Looking at some of the pieces of the puzzle here, you mentioned medication for treating people with opioid addictions. That includes medications like methadone. There's been some controversy in the past. People who advocate, I think, more of a 12-step approach have said if you're using methadone, you're not really solving the problem. Your organization, a lot of research, it sounds like, says, no, methadone really does work. Can you talk about the role medications like methadone play in beating addiction?
Absolutely. We found, again, when you look at this from the perspective of a health issue, there are all kinds of modalities to help people get into recovery. Not everybody does the same thing if they have diabetes. Some people manage it with diet and exercise. Some people need insulin. The important thing here is that we are making sure that all modalities and all things that can help people with treatment are available to everybody. And right now, they're not. Some people, it works just fine to use a 12-step approach. Other people actually use acupuncture. There are so many different modalities, but these new medications are important, and we want to make sure that nobody's denied being able to use them if between the person, the patient, and their practitioner, they determine that this might be something that can help them. Right now, we've had very little funding for these medications. Yes, there are some practitioners who feel like medications are not the way to go, but they are learning as everybody catches up with the research that in many cases, it makes sense for some people to use these, and we want to make sure they're available.
Well, that's on the treatment end. There's been a lot of focus on prevention lately and on the pipeline and away from prescription painkillers, opioid painkillers, to heroin or just addiction to the pain relievers themselves. What needs to happen at that level to prevent people getting addicted in the first place?
Well, and that's the other piece that's going on. There's several pieces on the prevention front. One is, as I said, prevention funding for very evidence-based programs that we have had in place for years and years for kids have been slashed, and we want to make sure those get put back in place at a community level and at a school level. But at the same time, our country is way out of whack when it comes to the number of opioids that are prescribed for pain relief. In many ways, doctors were under the, I think in some ways misguided, understanding that these opioids were good for chronic pain. We know now that they're particularly good for acute pain, short-term pain, but they're not so great for chronic pain. And so as a result, we have prescribed way too many. The CDC has now put out guidelines for doctors to begin looking at how they're writing these prescriptions, what patients are appropriate, what levels of pain are appropriate. And so we don't want to swing the pendulum back too far because we know that people who have pain, these can be very useful drugs in helping them manage this, but we are wanting prescribers and patients both to understand when they're looking at how they're going to manage this that there are other options and that those options should be explored before we just automatically write a script.
We're talking to Becky Vaughn, Vice President of Addictions at the National Council for Behavioral Health. We're looking at a bill that President Obama signed into law on Friday that aims to treat opioid addictions as a health problem.
And we want to hear from you on this. Has addiction, especially opioid addiction, impacted you or maybe a loved one? And what do you hope to see from people providing treatment and rehabilitation? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Maybe you're in the healthcare field. Tell us how you feel about treating addiction as a chronic health problem. Call 800-642-1234.
We'll be back with this conversation, maybe hear from you in just a moment here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Becky Vaughn, Vice President of Addictions at the National Council for Behavioral Health. We're talking about a bill signed by President Obama on Friday that's aimed at treating opioid addiction.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a problem for you or your family? Has someone you know been addicted to opioid pain medication or heroin? Is this an issue in your community? Are you seeing more and more cases of this? If you're a member of the community in healthcare, in law enforcement, what works? What doesn't? What would you like to see more support for? Maybe from the federal or state or local governments. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Becky, we've seen legislation here in Wisconsin, a state lawmaker whose own daughter actually has struggled with opioid addictions. He's taken the lead on a lot of new legislation here. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing states and local governments take the lead on this?
We are, and it definitely is not just a federal problem. We are looking, many states have said in law enforcement, they're looking to the federal government to help them understand kind of what they should be doing and what they can be doing. But it is important to recognize that the states play a role in this too. And the states have a responsibility to put more money into these things because this is having an incredibly negative impact, not just on individuals who are struggling with this disease, but on their families and on our communities. So it's important that the states also realize they have a role to play. And it's across all of these different modalities, from prevention to treatment to recovery support, criminal justice. For example, we have prescription drug monitoring programs so that prescribers can look and see if somebody's been to another doctor trying to get a prescription, or a pharmacy can look and see what's going on. These are in every state and the District of Columbia, except one, but many of the states, they're not mandatory. And that was something that was in the original CARA bill that was taken out before it was passed. And we know from data that when a state makes this mandatory, that we get much better much better impact when doctors are required to look at this database before they write a prescription. So that's just one example that states can step up their efforts on.
Let's go to our callers now. Bonnie is on the line in Brookfield. Bonnie, hi.
Hi. Yes, I have a daughter. She's over a year clean, and I also go to a Narnon group for parents of addicts. And I want to know, how is this bill going to affect insurance companies, which really hold a lot of control over whether the addict is going to get the treatment that they need, especially the medications and so forth, because there are nightmares that I could tell you of other parents and things that they've gone through.
Bonnie, good luck to you and your daughter. Becky, how would this affect insurance companies?
Bonnie, that's a great question, and it's a great point that I hear often when I'm traveling around the country. We do have parity laws already in place that require insurance companies to treat this just like they would treat any other medical or surgical issue. Sometimes those laws and regulations are not being enforced, and we see that very often. It often takes insurance commissioners to step in, or even attorney generals sometimes. But it's difficult for the patient or the patient's family to necessarily challenge all this all the time. This particular bill, again, emphasizes the need for enforcement for those parity laws. It doesn't directly address those issues because, again, we do have the laws on the books. But it is something that my organization and many organizations are continuing to push for stronger enforcement so that insurance companies are doing what they need to do to address this job, because they have a part in this and a role in this too, as you so aptly pointed out. And congratulations to your daughter, and I hope she has the support she needs so that she can maintain that recovery. Congratulations to you for finding ways to take care of yourself.
Bonnie, thanks a lot, and again, good luck to your family. Christy is with us next in La Crosse. Christy, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Christy?
Well, I work in a building where I work for a different company, but in the building there's a needle exchange. And so we see a lot of people come in, addicts come in, and just last week someone OD'd in the bathroom. And luckily, I mean, he was turning blue, but luckily he was saved. They we got the police there in time and the medics, and they did the Narcan. But there's a lot of conflict in our office about the needle exchange. And, you know, originally I think it was supposed to provide, you know, public safety and not having needles all over the place and a place for people to turn in their needles. But
Christy, I gotcha. Becky, how does needle exchange fit into the public health effort?
No, it's actually a very important part of this. It's referred to as part of what we call harm reduction, because very often when people who have these addictions, they obviously often can't afford a clean needle or have access to a clean needle. By reusing needles over and over again, we end up with the spread of many other things like hepatitis C and HIV. So these are ways not only to help reduce the harm, but every time a person comes in for a needle exchange, it gives us another opportunity to intervene and see if the person is ready to get some help with their addiction. So on two fronts, these programs are very important, and I applaud Wisconsin for having these programs available, because while it may feel uncomfortable to people in your building, this is very, very important that we have these. So again, we reduce the harm, but more importantly, it gives us many more opportunities. And very often a person will come in for a needle exchange and decide they really are sick and tired of being sick and tired and ready to get some help with treatment.
Christy, thanks for the call. We're talking to Becky Vaughn from the National Council for Behavioral Health, looking at opioid addiction and efforts to turn the tide. Morris is with us next in Eau Claire. Morris, hi.
Hello. Yes, my son is definitely an addict, and the law has not done anything to really help him. I mean, he has been busted multiple times. That doesn't deter him. The one thing that I wish they had was more things for rehabilitation. I wish he could go into the Army, the Navy, anything like that, because he does very well under a controlled circumstance, but get him out on his own, and he wants to do it. Also, it's an epidemic. He claims that at least 50% of the kids in his class have used, so it's bad. We need some help.
Morris, a big problem. And Becky, he makes me think people have talked about alternatives to incarceration, different kinds of courts for people dealing with addictions. Is that part of the puzzle?
Rob, it is part of the puzzle. And again, I'm so sorry in terms of what's going on with your son, because you're right. Once the brain has made this kind of change with these drugs, he's not making his own decisions anymore. This is a totally different arena for him. And what he does need, and no, being arrested is not going to deter him, because that's not what's going on. The brain is basically saying over and over again, I want more of that stuff. I want more of that stuff. Do whatever you need to do to get it. And so what will help him is if we can get him into treatment. And there are, in this bill, it talks more about diversion programs of getting people into treatment. Again, unfortunately, even when we have law enforcement and criminal justice programs that are ready to do what they need to do, we have a serious lack of treatment capacity so that we can actually get people into treatment. But that is where the difference comes, when people can get the help they need so that they can begin to help their brain heal and get back to a much more productive way of managing this disease.
And Morris, I hope your son can find the treatment he needs. And Becky, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Rob, Veronica, both. I always appreciate any program, any media that's willing to put a spotlight on this issue, so that people begin to understand that when we treat this like a health issue, we can have some great success, and it means so much to individuals, families, and communities.
That was Becky Vaughn, Vice President of Addictions at the National Council for Behavioral Health, talking about the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act of 2016, signed on Friday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time.